I'm Matthew Petty and this is Intersection. Children between the ages of 5 and 10 are getting arrested in Orange and Osceola counties at a higher rate than anywhere else in Florida. That's according to the Public Defender for Orange and Osceola counties. Robert Wesley wants to know what's going on, and he's urging residents in Central Florida to back him up and ask why more of their kids are being arrested than other parts of the state. Wesley says Miami's population is double that of Orange Osceola, and yet Miami arrests thousands fewer kids. He says troubled kids get turned over to school resource officers rather than counsellors or psychologists. Well, a state law takes effect next month. It will allow police to issue warnings or civil citations for some misdemeanours. Wesley hopes it will stem the arrest rate of young school kids. What are the reasons for the higher arrest rate for children? And what are the effects when children get turned over to law enforcement at schools? And if the arrest rate is too high, will this new law be enough to turn the tide? And what's happening in your child's school? You can join the News Roundtable on Intersection. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Well, joining me in the studio, Erin Sullivan, editor of the Orlando Weekly. Hi, Erin.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you along. Frank Torres, publisher of the Orlando Political Observer. Hi, Frank.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. And Matt Reed, welcome back from Florida today. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you. It's good to see you.
We're going to talk about the arrest rate for kids in Orange and Osceola counties. But first, back to a story we discussed last week, driver's licenses and a plan that could change the way those are issued. The state prints 5 million driver's licenses a year, and with the exception of a couple of counties, you can get it printed on the spot at a county tax collector's office. Proposal could centralise the way the licences get issued, though, and they'll be mailed out. After the show aired, we heard from Orange County Tax Collector Scott Randolph. He wanted to clarify a few things, and he joins us on the show now. Scott, nice to have you along.
Thanks, Matthew. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, just a quick primer. So how are licences issued now, and how could that change under this new proposal?
So in 2010, the state of Florida decided to begin closing its DMV offices around the state and hand that over to local tax collectors who were already doing some driver's license services, but of course were doing all the tag and title services. So beginning in 2010 was also the beginning of what they call the Real ID Act, where every single person with a license had to come into the office, show their birth certificate, passport, additional marriage certificate, additional documentation. So the state started phasing that. Their offices out, and actually back in the beginning of 2014, mid-2014, we took over all the driver's license services in Orange County, and most of the tax collectors have done so before the deadline that was the end of 2015. So now the state has proposed potentially centralizing the actual printing of the driver's license itself while the tax collectors would still be responsible for the actual customer service aspect.
Mm-hmm. So you'd still have to show up at the tax collector's office with all those documents you mentioned, but there'd be a bit of a wait before you got the actual license. Now, I understand there'd be a temporary sort of paper license issued in the meantime, right?
Exactly. It's actually a tough situation for, I think, everybody involved. And the reports show that there's definitely a need for increased security. The state of Illinois is starting to see a flooding of candidly fake driver's license straight from China. And Florida's starting to see that as well. And so across the country, I think there's a concerted effort to say, well, what can we do to increase the security? A fake driver's license, especially after the Real ID Act, is worth several hundred, if not thousands of dollars,
right,
on the black market. And so it's a very valuable document to have. And so how do we increase security? And so, you know, the state wants to centralize it with very expensive printing. And then, of course, though, that just ruins the customer service aspect because people lose their driver's license. Mm-hmm. People forget they need to get on a plane the next day. They can't wait for a week or two to get that license in the mail. So it's a tough spot of how do we increase security but maintain some type of customer service level.
Do you have any ideas for a way around it if it's not going to be have it centralized and mailed out from a central location?
Well, I'm having discussions with DHSMV on that issue, one of the things I've asked them to look into is there wasn't really a lot of discussions about, well, how expensive is this technology, at least not with the individual tax collectors. Obviously, a printer that may be a couple of $100,000 is going to be impossible to take into Hendry County or Glades County.
Right.
But here in Orange County, we do 350,000 driver's licenses a year. we may very well be, you know, may make cost-effective sense for us to be able to bring on that additional security and better printers and still be a regional office and be able to print those on site while DHSMB, maybe for the smaller counties, centralize the printing. But the bigger counties, I think, probably have the volume where it makes sense for us to still be able to print on site. And it gives that, even if you do regional like that, it gives everybody the potential, if they really, really had to get into one of those regional offices and get it printed same day on the spot.
So, Scott Randolph, it sounds like a fairly complex situation, but do you have a simple opinion on it one way or the other? Do you think it's a good idea to centralize it?
I do not think it's a good idea to centralize it. But we are going to have to address somehow the increased security for driver's license. Otherwise, Florida is going to get flooded with fraudulent documents. Mm-hmm. And that obviously, ironically, here on 9/11, that's the last thing we want is fraudulent documents out there that allow people to get into secure areas illegally.
Right. And just finally, to clarify something else, I think you wanted to talk about the cost. I mean, there is a small fee that you pay when you get your driver's license, like $6.50, I think. And that's supposed to cover some of the cost of the, getting that done at the tax collector's office. But is this a moneymaker for the tax collectors?
Oh, definitely not, especially the midsize and big counties. And even the legislative bill, when they did this in 2010, admitted that the state was going to save at least $16 million, and I believe it's much, much higher than that. My guess would be the state saved $25 or $30 million and pushed this down as an unfunded mandate down to local tax collectors. Here in Orange County, my guess would be it actually costs us probably $5 to $6 million just for the driver's license aspect. That's probably how much we lose every single year on driver's license. And I would say that's across the board, especially in the big county.
So why not centralize it? I mean, if that would take away some of the cost for tax collectors.
Well, that would be the terrible part. We'd simply go into customer service aspect. So practically all the cost is still there because we're doing the transaction. And then suddenly you're centralizing the printing. The printing itself is not the cost. Obviously, it's the customer service aspect. The scanning of all the documents that have to be done, the verification of documents that have to be done. That's the staff time. That's the cost of the transaction. And that's what's bad about centralizing is we would actually, there'd be no reduction in cost for us, really, very little.
Right.
But at the same time, we'd lose the customer service aspect of being able to get that driver's license on the spot.
Well, Scott Randolph is the tax collector for Orange County. We've been chatting a little bit about driver's licenses, that proposal at this stage to centralize printing and mailing of those licenses. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so moving on to the story about child arrest rates in Orange and Osceola counties. Public defender Robert Wesley says more children aged 5 to 10 are being arrested in those counties than anywhere else in Florida. According to the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice figures, last year 107 children aged 5 to 10 were arrested. And that's compared to 10 children in the 11th Circuit, which is Miami-Dade County, and 22 in the 17th Circuit, which is Broward County. Well, it's important to note that those arrest figures for the Ninth Circuit are down from 2010, when 197 children 10 and under were arrested. And according to the Department of Juvenile Justice, over the last five fiscal years, school-related arrests across Florida have dropped by about 49%. But here's Robert Wesley talking to 90.7 News on Wednesday.
A lot of parents think that tough love works, so that scared straight program of exposing a person to tough inmates in prison work, it actually is counterintuitive. That actually causes criminal behavior.
Well, Wesley says many of the arrests are happening in schools. He's hoping a new law that kicks in October 1st will give school resource officers more flexibility to issue warnings or citations so they don't just have to arrest those kids. But what options do schools have, and what's the solution if that arrest rate is too high? The ages that caught the headlines is 5 to 10, but rates are pretty high for all kids up to the age of 18. Join the conversation. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Aaron Sullivan, the Orlando Weekly reported on Wesley's push to lower the child arrest rate. What's your sense of why this circuit is arresting children at the rate it is?
I'm not sure I can say exactly why this circuit is arresting at such a high rate, but it's incredibly distressing to hear from our reporter who did the story that kids are being arrested for things like school uniform violations. I mean, really basic stuff. And I do think that there's maybe a lack of initiative to try different things like civil citations for kids, diversion programs for kids who have maybe a little more serious things going on, like where they're actually breaking rules and not just wearing the wrong uniform or speaking out of turn. I find it really troubling and disturbing. It was something I was really not aware of until Robert Wesley spoke up on this, and I'm glad that he did because these numbers are astounding.
And your reporter interviewed a former FAMU law dean, dean of the law school, Professor Leroy Purnell. He's quoted as saying many of the misdemeanors, as you say, were minor things: fist fights, dress code violations, talking back, and subordinate conduct. And he also said many of those kids are black. So what's the takeaway from this?
Well, the takeaway is that justice is not being meted out evenly or fairly across, you know, for all children, that black children, that probably Spanish children are as well, are being treated more harshly. Mm-hmm. I think we all know that the justice system is skewed and that, you know, in general, black males in particular tend to find themselves arrested and in trouble with the law a lot more often, and often for minor things that someone of a different race might not be bothered for at all. I think it's again, very disturbing to see that this is happening as young as 5 years old, because I think that when you tell a child at a very young age that they are bad, that they are a criminal, I mean, that sinks in and they take that with them into adulthood. And I think that's what we're probably seeing. I mean, if we're learning now that kids who are 5 years old could be arrested by a police officer, I think that's making a huge impression on, you know, these young minds that are very impressionable.
Mm-hmm. Matt Reed, what about Brevard County? Are there similar concerns about juvenile arrests?
There was a lot of pushback against zero tolerance policies in our school district, which are still around. But the way that our system is dealing with it seems to be on par with what's going on statewide. Our juvenile arrest rates and numbers have dropped about 41% over the last 5 years or so. Mm-hmm. And what I've heard from police departments in Brevard County and from the schools is that some of those diversion programs and the civil citation program are actually working pretty well. The thing that I think everybody agrees is that the sheer cost and the damage that you do to a person by putting them into the system when they are kids creates a long-term cost, right? You get kids that get put in, you know, they get arrested for, let's say, a little bit of pot or getting in a fist fight. Next mm-hmm. thing you know, they're getting fined and they're getting probation violations and they get arrested again. And now they're getting more and more consequences just from the fallout of, say, a loitering ticket, you know,
right,
early on. The civil citation program is really pretty interesting because that gives police officers a tremendous amount of discretion mm-hmm. to give somebody a ticket. They have to go before a judge. They have to, you know, pay restitution if they shoplifted or write an essay or volunteer at some place if they victimized, if they did vandalism. Very often the amount of time and effort and punishment that is exacted on the kid is more than they might have gotten in the system initially, but it gives them a second chance. It doesn't tar them for life with a mark on their permanent record.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, sending kids to, you know, the no frills, no fun diversion school, if they show up, you know, stoned at the prom or, you know,
right,
something like that at school is much, much better.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about, you know, prom level. We're way beyond 5 years old.
I can't get that out of my mind, that a 5-year-old might get arrested.
It's so disturbing. I mean, and imagine if I were a parent, you know, and my child at 5 or 6 years old, I got a phone call and they said, well, the police have come and they've arrested your kid for speaking back to his teacher. I'd be outraged, absolutely mm-hmm. outraged. And I believe parents probably are outraged. I think we're seeing a lot of information coming out about police tactics in this region, and people are finally speaking up about it. I think a lot has been happening for a long time, and people have just kind of absorbed it and figured this is the way it is. But with, you know, the Orlando Speaks stuff that's happening in Orlando now, and a lot of attention being paid nationally to these bigger issues, I think people are finally finding their voices to say, this isn't right. We've got to stop this.
Mm-hmm. Going to take a call now. We've got Chris on the line. Chris, doesn't seem like Chris is on there. Anyway, let's talk about legislative issues for a minute. Frank, obviously there's a law coming through on October 1st, there's going to be some changes, more options for police officers. How popular are these laws, do you think? Because on the one hand, you've got a tough-on-crime approach, and that's sometimes a popular gambit for politicians. But then if you're talking about kids, 5 to 10, it's a fine line, right?
Yeah, and well, you know, given how busy the agenda is in Tallahassee and all the work that the legislators have to do with redistricting, with an accelerated legislative schedule because of elections next year, it's really going to be about getting this thing in front of of the right committees mm-hmm. and getting the right legislator to shepherd this law around. If there isn't an event or a particular cost example that's going to get – the attention of all the other state lawmakers from different parts of Florida involved and interested, then it's going to be kind of tough to move it along.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Chris, you're on the air from Orlando. What are your thoughts on arresting children?
I don't even think that I can make a response, sir. I mean, that is just so ridiculous. You're arresting 5 to 10-year-old children. Isn't it bad enough that you arrest everybody for monetary gains? I mean, it's just unfathomable. Sorry, I just don't really know what else to say.
Is that the first you've heard of it, though? I mean, when did you become aware that kids age 5 to 10 could get arrested at schools?
When you said that, and what my first thought was, you know, the Kids for Cash scandal in Pennsylvania where they're sentencing children to juvenile detention centers because judges were getting kickbacks. And looking around our judicial system and seeing how it has become a for-profit institution in so many respects. And I teach a culinary program to disadvantaged people in Orlando, mm-hmm. and I encounter it all the time where you have a young person who has had a negative contact with the law, and from a young age, their hope of ever getting a decent job is ended.
Mm-hmm.
So this zero tolerance nonsense and the first response to everything is to incarcerate people has destroyed our economy, and it's destroyed hope, and it's destroyed lives. And one of the things that I hear a lot of, and I just can't wrap my mind around, is that there's always the black community is the ones that are the most victimized of it. Well, sure, they are. But the reality is it's the poor community that is the most victimized of this.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Thurgood Marshall that said years ago that, quote, it is better to be rich and guilty than innocent and a poor in America. And if we look around, you can really, truly see that.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have the abilities to defend yourself, you're guilty. And then if you look at our judicial system, there's something like a 96% conviction rate in our judicial system.
Yeah, and I think, Chris, the point was made by Robert Wisley that it's creating almost a school-to-prison pipeline. I think that's the phrase that was used. Chris, I do appreciate you calling in. Thank you so much for your thoughts there. Frank, just before we leave the subject, what else do you think might happen in terms of laws? I mean, if we give police officers have more discretion to, you know, to do what they need to rather than simply arrest a kid, be they 5 to 10 or even a little bit older than that, are other lawmakers likely to pick this up?
At this point right now with the agenda, I don't think so. I think this battle is going to have to be fought out. It's not really a battle, but this debate's going to have to be fought out on the ground in the municipalities among the law enforcement officers and among educators and parents. Of course, you know, these measures that have been carried out so far are really outrageous, but for it to really get attention on a statewide level, I think it's going to be mostly pushed down to the municipal issues and allowed to be handled between law enforcement and educators.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Space Florida moves ahead with plans for a commercial spaceport in Shiloh, which is in the Merritt Island National Wildlife Preserve. We'll talk about that story and some more issues. Intersection returns in a minute.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. Stay tuned.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Hospital, honoring firefighters throughout Central Florida who risk their lives every day to save the lives of those who otherwise would have perished. Florida Hospital, thanking firefighters who do not just stamp out flames, they change lives. Florida Hospital, life is amazing.
And the forecast for today, sunshine and a high near 92 with a chance of afternoon thunderstorms that could linger through tonight. Overnight lows in the mid-70s under a cloudy sky. Look out for more rain this weekend with lingering clouds and highs in the upper 80s and lows in the low 70s.
Support for 90.7 News comes from UCF College of Graduate Studies, announcing UCF Grad Fair September 15th from 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. The event showcases nearly 200 graduate and certificate programs. Attendees will have the opportunity to meet one-on-one with faculty, admissions, and financial aid. Details at graduate.ucf.edu.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Matt Reed from Florida Today, Aaron Sullivan, Orlando Weekly, and Frank Torres, Orlando Political Observer. Well, Space Florida is pushing for a commercial spaceport at Shiloh. It's a site that's part of the Merritt Island National Wildlife Preserve. Environmentalists have some concerns about it, and Florida Senator Bill Nelson said recently there's no need for the spaceport in the near term. But let's hear from Frank DiBello of Space Florida. Here he is talking. Space Florida is the state's economic development agency for aerospace.
We're fully in sync with the senator and believe that in the long run, what's important is what Shiloh represents. And Shiloh represents a fully commercial spaceport with all of the commercial operating conditions that the industry requires.
Frank DiBello says if Florida doesn't offer the spaceport, companies will launch elsewhere. Are you a resident of the Space Coast? Is Shiloh the site that Florida should be looking to develop as a commercial spaceport? And what's the downside? If they don't, is Florida going to miss out and are other states going to sweep in and grab these opportunities in this new commercial space race? 1-866-338-5252. Join the conversation. Well, Matt Reed, is there consensus on the Space Coast about what to do with that site at Shiloh?
No, I think that there's a lot of environmental activists who see, carving out a piece of Kennedy Space Center, which overlaps with the Merritt Island National Wildlife Refuge for commercial space launches, as awful. You know, they don't want that to happen, and there really aren't a lot of impassioned people who speak out on behalf of space, other than Space Florida, which is the agency that's trying to help us come back from the loss of the space shuttle program.
What about residents? Because, you know, there were plenty of folks who lost jobs, who some have had to move out of state after the shuttle program ended. There must be some of those who are saying, we need more of this commercial space activity here so we can get these good jobs back.
I think that if they understood a little bit better what was going on, they might speak out more, but people don't tend to speak out about things that they like, right? I mean, people speak out about things that they don't like. I think it's important to understand that we have already lost the segment that we're trying to capture here. The United States has had almost no commercial launch for years now. And what we're talking about with that are, you know, the rockets that launch, the satellites that, you know, T-Mobile and DirecTV and all these commercial companies use. We have a very, very busy rocket launch industry that launches military payloads, for example. And NASA is busy diversifying for human space flight and interplanetary exploration. But we don't have that commercial site. And what companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin and Orbital Sciences want is an easy to access small place that they're not going to be banned from, or they're not going to have to shut down, you know, their launch operations for security reasons. That military Air Force station is a military site first and foremost. And when they need to shut things down for security, that may delay commercial launches. In the business world, time is money. When somebody is financing a satellite and they need to start using it quickly, the last thing they need is to wait a month till they can get access to their launch pad again. So that's what they're trying to do here, is create a site that is not, that is outside that secure area, but unfortunately the one area that Kennedy Space Center has some say over is also a wildlife refuge. And really it's a fallow citrus town.
Right. It's basically a ghost town, isn't it? I've seen photographs of it. It's kind of interesting from an archaeological standpoint. But
right. It's not pristine. It is an old Florida ag area that that was a town that was basically condemned and shut down by the federal government when we created the Space Center. But it has been going back natural, and it's part of that whole waterway, and there are concerns about what happens when you have launches and pollution and people in an area like that. So, you know, it's a good issue. I wish that we could get a little bit more clarity out in front of the public about what this means and how much space business could be had from something like this. For now, Senator Nelson is right and Frank DiBello is right that, you know, the companies that would be doing this have found and are getting their businesses started at Kennedy Space Center and Canaveral Air Force Station. But eventually they need to keep their costs low for the clients, and they need something like this. And if we can't do it in Florida, they're doing it in Texas or New Mexico.
Frank Torres, so Frank DiBello says he's in sync, or Space Florida is in sync with what Senator Bill Nelson is saying, but it doesn't sound that way on paper. What do you make of Senator Nelson's comments that now's not the time for a a commercial spaceport there?
Well, you know, the political background involved with the Space Coast over the last couple of years, the reductions in jobs, the drawbacks in the space programs, and a lot of the controversies over the funding that does go towards the space program has been in the air. I think if there's an opportunity for a low-risk way to still get the program going, a compromise, if you will, between, you know, these people that want to do business there and the residents, then there could be some traction. But I think as far as seeing how it works out, I think both sides are still trying to feel out the issue and trying to see where it goes from here.
How much time do you expect to see Florida Senate candidates spending talking about the space industry leading up to that 2016 election?
Well, I think it'll be one of the issues leading up to it. I don't think it'll be a big issue because compared to the economy and foreign policy, especially these days, it'll get a mention here and there, but I don't see it being one of the premier issues in the Florida Senate race.
1-866-338-5252 is the number. If you live out on the Space Coast, want to weigh in on the subject. What are your thoughts on that potential commercial spaceport out there in Shiloh? 1-866-338-5252. Join the conversation. Matt Reed, let's talk about some other aspects of the aerospace industry. There are things happening there, a bit of diversification and sort of cross-pollination, as it were. Embraer just breaking ground on another plant, and this one, the Brazilian airplane manufacturer, is going to manufacture those aircraft seats. Do you get the sense there is enough diversity in the industry on the Space Coast now?
The thing that's nice about the Embraer groundbreaking is that this is a totally private sector commercial aerospace or aviation business. You know, we've done a good job over there of bringing in this kind of entrepreneurial spirit on the commercial crew program for NASA, for example. We've got SpaceX, Boeing, both competing with new technology to launch astronauts to the International Space Station. But that's still government spending, right? We've brought in Northrop Grumman and some other major defense contractors, but ultimately that's still very much government spending. So what's nice about seeing Embraer and Lockheed Martin, some of these other companies that are trying to diversify and become more private sector oriented. Harris Corporation is doing the same thing. I think that's encouraging and we're making progress there. I think in terms of jobs and employment, Brevard's got it going on right now. I think there are very few places in Florida where you're going to – you drive down some of our major boulevards and you see a lot of beige boxes. But there are a lot of highly paid engineers and people like that manufacturing and assembling and designing some pretty far-out stuff, and they make a pretty good wage. So want a way back.
And just before we leave this topic, Project Panther is on the way too. Jeff Bezos will be in Brevard County next week to talk about his Blue Origin program that's coming to the coast. Just how big of a deal is that?
Well, I think it's a space tourism effort, and you know, some people get very, very excited about that. It's a piece of the space industry that I think, you know, Space Florida and people like that want to see happen. I have a hard time seeing space tourism having much more impact than maybe a Hummer dealership. You know, I mean, it's a very specialized, high-priced thing for a very small number of people to participate in. I think there are other things that Blue Origin and Orbital Sciences and companies like that are doing right now that might have a much bigger impact, like building new rocket engines for commercial space launches so that we don't have to rely on engines from Russia, for example. And you know, if we can begin to concentrate some manufacturing and things in space over there, I think that would have a much bigger impact than maybe Project Panther in the long run.
And space tourism, if you talk about those flights, they're pretty short and sweet, right? I think maybe the sweet spot might be if they make those ships a little bigger and start space cruises. It's been the cruise state.
I mean, think about it. The tickets so far that they've been, you know, signing people up, and Virgin Galactic has done the same. We're talking about $189,000, $200,000 for a flight that might take minutes. I mean, my palms sweat just thinking about this, you know, going up and looking out the window. It's not for me, not that I could ever afford it, but I watch it almost as entertainment, and if they want to do it and they can, say, use the old shuttle landing strip at Kennedy Space Center to take off and land or just land, great. More power to them. It's something to add and it's something interesting. But as for the long-term economic impact, that's really hard to say.
Aaron Sullivan, obviously a lot of stuff is happening out in Brevard County, but there's some things happening here in Orlando too. I mean, we've got some big sort of military contractors, Lockheed Martin, et cetera. So there are some sort of spin-off effects from from the space industry being, you know, a big deal out on the coast. It's not just one part of the economy there.
No, it's not one part of the economy. It could have, it should have some impact here. I know that Lockheed's cutting back jobs, though, in other places. So I kind of wonder a little bit about how much presence they're going to have here. I don't really know. I mean, again, as Matt said, the economic impact is really tough to say. You can't really predict. So it's really, I think, a wait and see thing. I do think that, you know, there is a, I have a concern about the environment. I have a concern about seeing more of our natural environment kind of exploited for more development when there is plenty of developed stuff out there on the Space Coast that I'd love to see reused. We've got 15 endangered species in that area that Shiloh is looking at. And I know that nature is starting to take it back, but I think we need more of that and less, you know, kind of tearing up hundreds and hundreds of acres at a time to make room for more, you know, just stuff. It would be great if it would have an economic impact on us, but can't we find a different way to, a different space to make that happen?
Mm-hmm. Frank?
You know, you were mentioning earlier if the Florida Senate candidates would mention space travel and things along, probably things along those lines. But as far as economic opportunities and the modeling, simulation and research simulation here in Central Florida, you'll get every lawmaker excited if you talk about any possible growth in that area, especially since they're trying to move beyond Florida's reputation as just a tourism capital. They're trying to demonstrate how diverse they are as far as economic interests and any possibility to do that. You'll have every lawmaker within 50 miles of Florida raising their hands trying to get those opportunities.
I'm going to go to the phone now. We've got a call from Titusville. Bill, you're calling from Titusville. What are your thoughts about this site out in Shiloh?
I am strongly against developing the site in Shiloh for any commercial development, space, or any other construction. Merritt Island Wildlife Refuge was set aside for the protection of the wildlife in that area, the protection of the Indian River Lagoon, and the protection of the Mosquito Lagoon. This is a very important wildlife area. The wildlife of Florida has been decimated by constant development. The Indian River Lagoon is in severe distress, damaged by constant development and not making adequate protection for the environment. Mm-hmm. This is why I'm against it. Many people are moved to Florida because of the wildlife and because of the environment, but if we constantly develop every portion and destroy our natural land, there will be Florida could become a desert.
Well, let me ask you this, Bill. First of all, have you visited that Shiloh site?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I've been through that Shiloh site. I am a volunteer working on Merritt Island Wildlife Refuge, and I am very concerned with Cape Canaveral, you know, the Canaveral National Seashore, and that whole area around Mosquito Lagoon. I have put oyster beds in Mosquito Lagoon trying to rebuild it.
Do you think there's a balance, though, between trying to create an industry where you have good, high-paying jobs, which I think most people agree that, you know, engineering jobs are the way to go for Florida if we want to sort of really build up the economy there, and preserving what we have in terms of natural resources?
Florida is being decimated by the promise of high-paying jobs. High-paying jobs should be put in more industrial areas. They can be put down near Cape Canaveral. Mm-hmm. They can be put down in the present area that's been set aside, you know, like in Kennedy Space Center area.
Mm-hmm. But I think there are
constantly destroy our environment for the promise of jobs, because
I think there are, Bill, if I could just interrupt, I think there are some kind of payoffs there between, you know, you can't really put a rocket launch site in an already populated area. So that's kind of the catch 22 of that situation, as it were. But I do appreciate your call. Thank you so much for calling in. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about cycling. Florida still has the dubious distinction of being the most lethal state for cyclists, even as the fatality rates decline. So if you want to weigh in on that subject, give us a call, 1-866-338-5252. Intersection returns in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Giving Films, presenting 90 Minutes in Heaven, based on the book of Don and Eva Piper's incredible true story of perseverance and overcoming the challenges of life and death, starring Hayden Christensen and Kate Bosworth. Now playing. More at 90minutesinheaventhemovie.com.
Hi, I'm LaFontaine Oliver, president and general manager of your public radio station, WMFE. Did you know that you can stream WMFE news and classical music directly from the WMFE.org website? Just click on the button that says Listen Live.
Sponsored by the Rollins Kremer Graduate School of Business. Support for 90.7 News comes from AmScott Financial, offering financial services to Florida since 1989. AmScott Financial is a proud program sponsor of public radio on 90.7 FM. More information online at amscottfinancial.com.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Matt Reed from Florida Today, Frank Torres from the Orlando Political Observer, and Aaron Sullivan, Orlando Weekly. Well, turning out of cycling, Florida does have that distinction of being still the most lethal state for cyclists, even as the fatality rates decline. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention brought out some new stats last week. They go up as far as 2012, when 118 cyclists were killed in Florida. The study found the cycling fatality rate for kids declined, while the death rate for adult cyclists went up. And that could be because more adults are riding bikes to work. Are you a cyclist? Are you surprised that Florida is still the top state for cycling fatalities? And what's it like riding your bike, whether it's to work or for fun? 1-866-338-5252. Join the conversation. Aaron Sullivan, Orlando has made some strides in getting things more cycle-friendly. There's bike share. We've got some street redesigns underway, including bike lanes. What else do you feel needs to happen to make this an even more friendly city for cyclists?
As someone who lives in one of the corridors that you cannot really safely ride your bike from home to work, I've tried and I've ridden my bike, and I think that there are roads where there is little to no shoulder. There, you know, in addition to having zero bike paths, you can't really ride on the sidewalks. Sidewalks are not, you know, not only should you not, but they're not really in very good shape to ride on. I think more connectivity between the bike paths that exist, because we do have some going in that have kind of connected various pockets of Orlando with ways to get downtown from one neighborhood to the next. But if we could create ways that you can get from South Orlando to downtown, or from any neighborhood to a SunRail station, from a SunRail station to your work, I think it would make a huge impact. And I know Orlando is talking a lot about this. And I think that if our various transportation organizations can kind of get together and talk about how they can create some connectivity and create some plans for people, I think it's going to make a huge impact. Because right now, cycling is very dicey. It's hit or miss around here.
Literally, in some cases. Well, Orlando's getting bigger too, and that means more cars on the roads, but it could also mean more cyclists. I wonder if that could actually be a good thing. You know, you get that critical mass, you have more cyclists on the streets. Positive?
Yeah, and I mean, critical mass is very active here, and if you've ever seen their rides, I mean, they get tons of people going out and just, you know, taking over for a night. I don't think, though, that we have a culture that is completely welcoming of them or of any riders yet. I mean, sometimes you'll see police officers hassling critical mass riders, which is really distressing. I also think that there's just a car culture here that is still dominating a lot of people's minds. I mean, they want to drive from their East Orlando home out to downtown where they work, and they don't want to have to slow down for cyclists or worry about them. I think they're annoyed by them. But if you see more of them on the street and more people are actively taking part in cycling in Orlando, you're not going to have any choice. I just want to see the governments take some effort to make sure that people are aware. Education campaigns, more bike paths, more connectivity, like I said, and just an awareness in general of cyclists on the road.
Mm-hmm. Going to go to the phones now. We've got a call from Jay. Jay, you're calling from Orlando. What's on your mind about cycling in the central Florida area?
Well, I do bicycle quite a bit, and I enjoy it. I have a twofold, kind of like a dichotomy here. We get a lot of bicyclists here in Lake Nona. We have excellent bike lanes. And I think the thing that a lot of the drivers resent is some of the bicyclists have this defiant sort of attitude, go around me sort of attitude. You'll see a lot of them in the bike lane, but you always get this one or two guys that just want to ride in the car lanes.
Mm-hmm. And I think they are within their rights, though, to ride in the car lane. I think that's something that maybe people who use the roads don't quite understand. If you're a cyclist, you have a right to be in that lane. I know some motorists obviously don't like it because it slows them down, but you're within your rights to do that.
I didn't know that. I thought if you had a bike lane, you had to stick to the bike lane. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the other side of it, me, when I'm on a bicycle, I've seen such an influx of people from, say, places like New York and New Jersey, where they seem to have this me-first attitude in their car, and they'll just cut right around you and come to a stop at a stop sign where you pretty much have to avoid plowing into the back of them. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of twofold. I don't know what the answer is, but just my experience here in the Lake Nona area.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jay, thank you so much for your call. The perspective from somebody who rides a bike and drives a car. Appreciate you calling in there. Matt Reed, what's it like in Brevard County? How cycle friendly is it?
It's a mixed bag. I mean, the one thing that is nice to see is that when I moved here, I am a cyclist. I cycle for fitness and on weekends and that kind of thing, and for triathlon. And I think that the cycling for that has gotten much more popular. And you can see on state roads where the budgets are better and people are trying to do things like open the Pineda Causeway from the beach to the mainland, really good marking, really good bike paths. Of course, every time they open up something like that, the prediction is that it's going to be a bloodbath and people are going to get hit. And it's never as bad as those predictions are. The one concern that I have is that we have a lot of city and county roads that have terrible access for bicycles. No shoulder, no place to ride. It's hard to make a loop or to get around or to get to work if you want to. And the city and county governments over there are so strapped for road money to pay. They're one of the few counties in the state that have actually capped their own tax rates. So we're now locked in at, you know, recession housing bust levels for the foreseeable future, that I can't imagine them, when they do need to repave a road, having the money to really widen them and expand them or put in bicycle paths. But I sure wish that's what they did.
So talking about the funding and the like, Frank Torres, one of the legislative wins, if we just cycle back to, March of this year in Florida, that legislative session, there was more money for cycling trails, connecting up some of those trails. Do you think this is a sign of a more cycle-friendly attitude amongst lawmakers? I know some of them do like to get on their bikes and ride around.
Yeah, there are a few bike riders up there in Tallahassee. Absolutely. I think this is a measure, a step towards a more cyclist-friendly Florida, but also you're seeing a lot more initiatives here in Central Florida as well, done on the municipal levels. You'll recall Orlando was named one of the worst cities for pedestrians a couple of years back. I think there's some spillover into the cyclist arena in that regard. You're going to see both the county and the city spend more money on bike trails, more money on safety markings to try to really eliminate that reputation of being such an unfriendly community for cyclists.
1-866-338-5252 is the number. Are you a cyclist in the Central Florida area? What's it like in your neck of the woods to get on your bike, whether you're riding to work or recreationally? Aaron Sullivan, are taxpayers, do you feel prepared to spend the money needed for engineering improvements if that were an option? If you talk about cycle lanes, bridges, even just improving the shoulder of the road, is that something people want to spend money on?
Well, I think as we're improving our roads in general, this should be built in. I don't think it has to be or should be a huge cost to taxpayers just to add some bike lanes to roads. We're constantly seeing improvements going on, especially, again, right along Colonial Drive, for instance. How much money is being spent out here? You see bicyclists on this roadway all the time. It is not safe. I certainly hope that when they started making those improvements, they thought, what are we going to do to make the cyclists and the pedestrians safer? Because you need that out here. It is deadly dangerous sometimes, or it was. Now it's kind of hard to tell because it's all torn up. And I just don't think this should be something that we create special funds for. I think it should be built in. Our city was built around a car culture. I think that as attitudes change, as things change, we just have to build in different mentalities and how we're developing and how we're improving our infrastructure.
Matt Reed, do you get the sense that taxpayers out in Brevard County would like to spend more money? I mean, if that was an option, you know, obviously we have sales taxes and the likes. Oftentimes those go towards schools, those kind of improvements. But what about cycling? Is there a kind of a cohesive feeling that people would like to spend more money if it meant better roads, better conditions for cyclists?
Brevard's a pretty cranky, conservative place. I don't think anybody's going to raise any taxes to pay for accommodating cyclists, especially when there's so many people that you hear from in our newspaper, either through letters or story comments, who just don't like cyclists. I mean, I don't understand that part where, you know, if I see them, I'm going to give them the finger, or I'm going to tell them what for and stop blocking my way. And I don't know what to do about people like that. But, I think that what we have seen steadily, major road by major road, is the addition of things that make it easier. For example, we've got now some trails that have been connected so that people in Vieira, which is one of our big sprawling western suburbs, can actually make it all the way to the beach if they give it a try. It's not a place you want your kids riding their little bike with training wheels or anything, but if they really want to give it a go, they can ride a beach cruiser or, you know, a road bike all the way over to the beach. Mm-hmm. And that's big for Brevard, and we're coming along. Certainly, again, cycling is becoming much more popular over there as a recreational activity. Baby boomers are doing a lot more running and cycling and that kind of thing than golf. And so I think that as people see these bike paths and they begin to take them for granted a little bit and enjoy them as part of the quality of life, they're going to come to expect them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a positive trend.
Going to go to the phones now. We've got Arthur, you're on the line from Orlando. What are your thoughts on cycling in the City Beautiful?
Yes, I came out here from Northern California around 2006, and I had been an avid road cyclist and mountain bicyclist for, 2 to 3 decades. And it was within my first year of relocating here to Florida that I actually gave up cycling entirely. I just was not willing to risk my life for my hobby. It just was clear how dangerous the roads are out here. And what actually confirmed my decision to give up cycling entirely was the fact that my auto insurance rates increased from California to Florida, which told me a lot about the dangerous conditions here on the road. Mm-hmm. And I don't cycle to work. I don't see it as a feasible option for me. So I'm not that in tune with expanding our trail systems, mm-hmm. and increasing the bike lanes. I think the real problem is the, lack of compassion or understanding for cyclists sharing the road.
Mm-hmm. Arthur, thank you so much for your call, sharing that perspective of somebody who moved to the state and decided it was a bridge too far to jump on your bike here. Do appreciate you calling in. Going to go to Jim now. Jim, you're calling from Claremont. What's on your mind about cycling?
Well, I'll take the counterpoint to the last caller. Mm-hmm. You live in an area like Claremont where there's lots of two-lane rural twisty roads, and I'll come around a curve doing the speed limit, and I've got three guys on bicycles, three abreast across my lane. Mm-hmm. It's really hard. It's not a question of me being aggressive and not respecting the cyclist, but if they're not going to ride at least on the shoulder in a straight line, they're putting themselves in harm's way because they're just assuming that, I don't know what, that I'm going to see them, that I'm always going to be on the outlook for them and come around a curve, and there's three of them there.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for your call, Jim. The perspective of a motorist there saying that cyclists really need to think about what they're doing on those roads, especially the narrow ones out in the countryside. Taking another call now, Louis, you're on the air from Orlando. What are your thoughts on cycling?
Well, I do think that generally commuting to work is difficult, but I'm lucky enough to live on the West Orange Trail in Oakland, mm-hmm. and at least from my exercise point of view, I love being outside, and it's better than being in the gym, and I can go for, I ride about a 14-mile bike ride every other day.
Yeah.
For me, it's the weekends when there's a lot of the weekend work.
Mm-hmm. Louis, you're starting to drop off there, but I know the trail you're talking about. It's a fantastic trail, the West Orange Trail, and if you happen to be fortunate to live on it, then that could be a good option for getting to work. One more call on this before we move on. Got to go to Constance. Constance, you're calling from Titusville. What are your thoughts on cycling out where you are in Titusville?
Oh, yes. Well, I was an avid cyclist. I started out being to be green, to ride to the grocery store because these things are nearby. But the culture of the that's present in the traffic is very intimidating. If you're following the law and staying to the right on the lane, people are just obviously with their language of their vehicle, like going around you and then trying to cut you off. When they have, it's just I stopped riding on the road, mm-hmm. because it's so intimidating. It's obvious. There's so many people behind the wheel who do not want the cyclists. That mm-hmm. was my experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that'll change. But thank you so much for your call, Constance. Do appreciate it. I'm going to talk just finally about politics. Here is Jeb Bush. He got on some national TV. He got a little bit of national TV time this week. He released an ad. He also was on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Let's hear a little snippet of that.
Without in any way diminishing your love for your brother, in what ways do you politically differ from your brother George?
I'm obviously younger.
You're younger. Uh-huh.
Much better looking.
Uh-huh. Policy, though. Any policy?
Yeah.
and policy differences?
I think my brother probably didn't control the Republican Congress spending.
Well, a pretty short segment there, but a final question for our panelists here. I'm going to start with you, Frank. In the last 30 seconds here, did this appearance help Jeb Bush's cause?
We haven't seen any new poll numbers, but right now he really needs to hope it did, because he's placing fifth or sixth going into this next debate. He's losing traction. He needs to do something.
And Aaron Sullivan, not sure if you saw that Late Show episode, but what are your thoughts? Did it help Jeb Bush?
I don't think it's going to hurt him. I think it's people are talking about it like crazy, which is what he needs. I think the Bushes are really good at kind of connecting with the common man and being folksy and cute, and that's exactly what he did.
Mm-hmm. And Matt Reed, final few seconds. What are your thoughts? Good for Jeb Bush?
I couldn't hurt. The guy's got to start at least running a strong second to stay in this. I think that people like him. He polls well in terms of honesty and likability and all those things you normally like in a regular year. Mm-hmm. But the Donald Trump thing is out there, and gosh knows how he's going to handle that.
You've been listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We've been joined by Matt Reed, editorial columnist and host of The Matt Reed Show with Florida Today. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Thank you, Frank.
Anytime.
And Aaron Sullivan with the Orlando Weekly. Thank you so much, Aaron.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening, and join us again next Tuesday morning at 9.